This is the session on global warming, reporting on what's going on in your own backyard. As a journalist, I've been writing about these issues more than two decades. When I worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer, this was very much a theoretical discussion. At least that's what we were told. This was a theoretical discussion about what would happen in the future. And we had many arguments with editors over how important this story was. That has significantly changed in recent years, and now we have gotten to the stage where I think the debate over the science is essentially over. Obviously, at least the major currents of the science are over, and there are impacts that are being felt all over the country. In Michigan, where I live, there's great concern about global warming and climate change, the impact on the tart cherry industry, the fishing industry of walleyes, brook trout, impact on birds, bird migrations, agriculture, and certainly the Great Lakes and the water levels in the Great Lakes. There are concerns like this all over the country, and many of the scientific assessments now are well underway for reporting about what is happening on the local level. So you're going to be hearing more about that today. I do want to say a couple things. The sessions, there's a lot of resources that will be discussed this morning, and there are many handouts on the table over there, but there will be posted on the SEJ website a variety of the resources that are mentioned in the panel today. So if you don't get something, they will be posted fairly soon. All right, we have three panelists this morning, and we're going to start with, I will first just briefly give you an introduction of each of the three, and then we will start. Our first speaker is Rick Piltz. He is the founder and director of Climate Science Watch. I think some of you know his background. From 1995 until 2005, he served in senior positions in the Office of the U.S. Climate Science Program, and in March 2005, he resigned under protest over what he felt was the politicizing of the science under the Bush administration. Our second speaker is Cynthia Rosenzweig. She's a research scientist at the Goddard Institute Goddard Institute of Space Studies at NASA in New York City. She's the head author of a chapter on climate impacts in the coming report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and specifically she's been looking at the impact in the New York region. And our third speaker is Doug Hinckley, a senior scientist of the National Wildlife Federation. He has written fact sheets about the impacts of global warming on individual states, which are available there as well as online and on a disk, so if you want to find out locally. And I have to mention, he's a Spartan, graduate of Michigan State, 1976. So we're going to start with Rick Piltz.
Well, and I'm an alum of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, so let's go blue. Just a few words by way of introduction. I've been working on in environmental and energy policy research, analysis, and advocacy since 1979. I've been working in Washington, D.C. since 88 and focused primarily on the global climate change problem since then. I came at this issue originally from more the policy side, but during 4 years on the professional staff with the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology in the early 90s, I became more engaged with the science issues and the relationship between the development of scientific understanding of global climate change and national policy making, and have kind of worked on that interface. From 1995 to March of last year, I was in the coordination office of the federal program that supports all the research and global observations on the climate and global environment. And I resigned in March of last year seeing how the administration was, in my judgment, undermining the integrity and credibility of climate science communication in order to suit a political message I turned some materials over to Andy Revkin at the New York Times, and he did a front page story on it in June of last year on how an oil industry lobbyist in the White House Environmental Policy Office had marked up climate science program documents in such a way as to play down the global warming problem. And shortly after that story ran, he resigned and went to work for ExxonMobil. So the story had a nice kind of narrative shape to it. Since then, I've developed Climate Science Watch as a public interest watchdog initiative that does investigation, communication, and reform advocacy on these issues, basically with the aim of holding public officials accountable for the integrity with which they use or misuse climate change and related research in policymaking. So I am not a journalist, I'm a source. And our website, climatesciencewatch.org, is a source of our running investigation commentary on issues having to do with the censorship of a federal climate scientist, the operation of the global warming denial machine, as we call it, some independent oversight of the federal program. So I have a viewpoint from Washington basically on the political context you face in attempting to cover issues of global warming impacts at the local and regional level. So it's not, I'll leave the science education for Cynthia and Doug. This is somewhat more of a political piece, but I think it's essential to understanding what happens when you start to talk and publish on climate change impacts. I found that the administration has numerous mechanisms for manipulating and impeding climate science communication. It's not so much a matter of telling scientists what to study and what to publish in geophysical research letters and the other technical journals. The gatekeepers step in when communication extends out of the science community to a broader audience, in the media, to the Congress, to civil society in general. And one can point to disappearing websites. The EPA global warming website went completely moribund for 4 years until just recently. NOAA stopped issuing press releases almost entirely for a few years on climate research findings. The attempt within NASA to keep Jim Hansen from talking to the press, which was foiled by a fairly aggressive pushback, but not all federal scientists have that cachet to be able to do that. The kinds of swift boat tactics that we saw from Senator Inhofe's representative in the plenary yesterday evening. So the net effect, I think, has been to misrepresent the intelligence on climate change and thereby undermine national preparedness. Now, I think, to bring it around to impacts, global warming impacts is one of the key areas that is politically sensitive under this administration and its supporters. And I think that the central scandal, climate science scandal of the last 6 years, is not a particular industry agent marking up particular reports, but it is the comprehensive suppression of the national assessment of climate change impacts. This was a study that was commissioned by the White House Science Office in the late 90s, published in the 2000-2001 timeframe, conducted by independent teams of eminent climate scientists and other experts, transmitted to the President and to the Congress, published, and is the most substantial effort to date that has been undertaken to bring expertise around the country to bear on the question of what are the potential consequences of climate change for the United States, societal and environmental consequences down at the national and then down to the regional and sectoral level, Pacific Northwest, Gulf Coast, New York metropolitan area, forestry, coastal and marine resources. There's a whole body of documents that was produced that was a first step in what I think is an essential process that should have the highest level support of bringing scientists and other experts together with policymakers, so-called stakeholders, resource managers, civil society, media, in dialogue and diagnosis of where are we vulnerable to climate change, what does it mean, what are the potential consequences, what are the things we need to be thinking about in terms of response strategies, what are appropriate ways to discuss these issues. That was a process and set of documents that was a very non-congenial to powers in Washington that had a predetermined political position to not acknowledge the global warming problem or take any steps really to deal with it. So it's a very long story, but I'll shorten it for our purposes. But essentially, the national assessment identified a broad range of potential consequences of climate change for the U.S., including a range of likely adverse consequences for society and the environment, everything to do ranging from urban infrastructure to coastal zone problems from sea level rise and storm surge, Pacific Northwest forests, and all over the country. It got media attention. It got some congressional attention. And so there was a systematic campaign to suppress this work. Senator Inhofe and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is an ExxonMobil-funded advocacy group, filed a lawsuit to suppress any distribution of the national assessment, to try to make it vanish. He filed a second lawsuit in 2003 to try to make even links to the documents removed from the web, from the government website, an action that some of us refer to as bite burning. And the lawsuits were withdrawn. They've gone away, but the denialists won the political victory. The White House gave them the political victory. Phil Cooney, the oil industry lobbyist in the White House Environmental Policy Office, directed the Climate Change Science Program agencies that there would be no further use of these documents. There's no reference to them in climate science program reports to Congress. There's no reference to them in the program strategic plan. The whole process of scientist-stakeholder interaction that had been initiated was killed. Support was pulled for it. There's been no follow-on. The National Academy of Sciences, in their review of the Climate Change Science Program, criticized the program for not using the national assessment. They said it was a seminal study, an important, a credible study, exemplary for the way scientists engaged non-scientists in discussing the issues. The administration had somehow dropped the use of this and never given any reason why, and that, in fact, is the case. They never have given any reason why they've suppressed the report. They've just suppressed it. In a recent article in Greenwire on the national assessment, Senator Kerry recently raised this issue with the administration, called for the conducting a second national assessment, and I think there's an impending lawsuit will be introduced in federal court in California soon to compel the administration to conduct a second national climate assessment. Myrony Bell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute said, to the extent that we've made that report vanish, we have succeeded. And that's an archetypal denialist statement. It's not just a story about the past, although it's a good story that I'm trying to write up in some depth, but it's a question more of what the country is losing for the last 6 years by not having high-level political, governmental support for the type of process that the National Climate Impacts Assessment initiated. And I'm not just talking about lifting the heavy hand of censorship from scientists, but really of embracing what comes out of the mainstream science community and using it and incorporating that into national policy-level discourse and acting on it as appropriate to deal with the issues that are raised. And so we do not have now this this process, and we're not producing a second round of national assessment papers. And yet I think if we did have high-level leadership from that, there would be very substantial interest in participation by scientists. There would be very substantial interest in participation by state and local officials, by private sector people, by experts all over the country, and there would be substantial media interest. So anything that you do to address the question of what are the potential consequences of global climate change for your particular locality or region, anything you can do to bring together expert sources with media and with users of the information among public officials, resource managers, educators, is a step toward carrying out that sort of process. I just think it's unfortunate that that's going on now on an entirely ad hoc basis around the country rather than on a more orchestrated basis. And I don't mean politically controlled. I mean intellectually independent, but with a high-level public support for an orchestrated process so that it becomes part of a national dialogue on what are we going to do about the global warming problem.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Rick. Our next speaker is Cynthia Rosenzweig of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies at NASA in New York City.
Good morning. NASA scientists like to come with their PowerPoints, so I am going to share with you in my talk some of the types of information that we do use as we work with the decision makers in the New York metropolitan area. And this work follows directly from the U.S. National Assessment that Rick was just describing, the foundation work for climate change in the New York metropolitan region, and as it turns out in urban areas, was the Metro East Coast Regional Assessment, which was done as part of the National Assessment. It was, I believe, a very important foundation work for the region and also for urban areas in general. And so while I'm going to be focusing on climate change in my backyard, which is the New York metropolitan region, the theme is also climate change impacts in urban areas. Being invited to speak here, I thought about, well, how do you address the issue of news in climate change impacts? And so what I am going to be pointing out through the next 10 minutes or so is some new information, new ways that we are approaching climate change impacts in urban areas. So here we are in New York City. 21.5 million people live in the region. And the challenge is to bring the global issue down to regional relevance. And the first thing that's new is the climate projections that are shown on this slide, because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fourth Assessment Report, which is coming out next year in 2007, has engendered an entirely new set of global and hence national and hence regional climate change scenarios. So that is the first thing that's new, that we can now have. And these sets of scenarios are really scenarios of record for about 5 years, and these new projections are just being brought forward, and they're all housed on a website called PCMDI. So in terms of climate change impacts for any particular region in the nation, I urge you to use the latest scenarios, which are for the IPCC AR4. That's the acronym for the fourth assessment report. How do we, second thing that I think that in terms of how we relate the climate change issue to our city and to any location, is to look at current climate trends. While climate change still has this element of, for example, these were for the 2050s relative to the climate normals just of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So, but still, 2050 is still very, it's pretty abstract thinking about what will happen even for almost more than four decades from now. So when we work with our decision makers, and this is something we learned from the Metro East Coast Regional Assessment, is we ground our work in the current. So it's very interesting to look in any region at what the current climate trends are. So these are the trends for Central Park with the urban heat island removed. And what we find is that in New York City, the trend of temperature is actually the slope, and the growth rate is the warming trend is greater than the global average. So it's I urge you also to check with your local meteorologist to see what are the trends in the region. In terms of precipitation, which is the lower graph, that of course is much harder to see changes related to the global warming, the climate change issue. But what we do see in our region is a slight increase in the mean precipitation. But if you see to the right how much more jagged those ups and downs are, we do see an increase in the standard deviation, in the variability of our precipitation. This is While it is very hard to say this is global warming, and we are very careful not to say that or associated with global warming, but this is an intensification of the hydrological cycle, which is what the models suggest comes with global warming. That was over the past 100 years, but of course I know that people relate to what's happening in recent decades. So this is just the last 30 years, in particular when the greatest amount of changes have been occurring. And what we see in our region, and you can look to see what's happening in each one of your regions, is that in the recent 3 decades, the trends are actually accelerating, both in terms of warming and in terms of the increase in precipitation. From there, once we look at the recent trends, grounding in that current climate, I think is very important. And we've learned that from working with our decision makers. Then we go to the projections. By putting the projections in context, then these are, again, for the suite of projections for the 2020s, 2050s, and 2080s. And what the 3 different colors stand for are 3 different emission scenarios. This we then tie into, of course, the low, medium, and high greenhouse gas emissions and the pathways of what those mean for the region. You can see that the choices of the low and the medium or the high, which is the challenge to our global society of which emission pathway we're going to follow, is very clearly demonstrated that if we keep choosing the high, we have a very big potential warming as we go through the decades. So these are with the new scenarios, but we now also have something very new in the way that we present these scenarios, which is shown in this slide, which is to bring in the paradigm of risk, climate risks. Previous ones looked more like this, in which we said these are the mean climate changes for the 2050s, 2080s, et cetera. But now what we do is we take a suite of 5, in our case for the New York region, 5 GCMs and 3 emission scenarios, and we have 15 possible model emission scenario combinations. And by projecting them as probabilities, as we see here, we're able to communicate the potential risks of climate, I believe, in a much more realistic way for our stakeholders. So we're including risk, and we are also including and showing the uncertainty. And this was one of, in the panel last night, one of the points that Andy Revkin made, that it is very important as we communicate about climate change science to include the uncertainty. So just taking the 2050s, or let's just take the 2020s because it's closest. What we see is that the models, those model emission scenarios give a range of 1 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit, and these are in Fahrenheit because of working with our stakeholders for understanding. But we see that most of the models then, those model emission scenarios, are centering on 1.5 to 2. So you can see that presenting the information this way gives a lot more information, and I believe is representing the science in a better way. Of course, linking to current climate stresses is very, very important, even as we do the projections. So in the New York area, what people care about with the weather are the nor'easters, the hurricanes, and, of course, then heat waves and droughts and floods. Now, when we come to the one that everyone always asks about, of course, we have the issue with the hurricanes, and I'm sure all of you have been following the intense flurry of articles about hurricanes. So because hurricanes have become more intense in the last 30 to 50 years, it is very important for our decision makers. And so, for example, we do a great deal with the New York City Water System, the Department of Environmental Protection. They actually came to us before Katrina and said, we have to work better on responding to the hurricanes that we have now. And please tell us also, what is the state of the science in terms of hurricanes in the future? And it's this interplay between the current extremes, improving responses, and then bringing the climate change projections into account for longer-term planning is, I believe, where we are in terms of decision makers. Of course, then, for us in the Atlantic here, the frequency has to do with what's happening with El Nino, and that's why we cannot say anything in particular about the frequency in the future because of the uncertainty with the El Nino. What we do in terms of extreme events is follow what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change does, which is survey all of the literature and then give qualitative statements. And that's what these are. I won't go through them all, but you can see that. And on the bottom, what is something that we also have learned from IPCC, which I think is very good, that when you give a statement of likely, or when you are interviewing a scientist and they say, well, it's likely to do this, ask them what probability they would associate with those likelihoods. And with IPCC, and you might be interested in reading it, there is what we call the uncertainty Bible, the uncertainty document. And becoming more precise about expressing uncertainty is an important part, I believe, of where we are now in the field. Everyone asks in our region, and I'm sure in your regions too, about the low probability, high impact scenarios. So we now have to include these as we work with our stakeholders. But how to do that? We have our model-based scenarios, which is what I showed you before. That's clear for those are the projections for the coming decades. But we also now have to be tracking these potential very high risk but lower probability. So what we do with our decision makers now is bring this into our scenario framework in terms of tracking what's going on with the ice sheets and what is going on, for example, with the conveyor belt. We track these, though, in qualitative terms and then again create qualitative statements around the state of the science for these. Turning now to the impacts, I focus on the climate. With cities in particular, but I believe everywhere, we now are in a stage that we need to be integrating across. Most across the different sectors. Most impacts work has for the for two decades been stovepiped to here's the effects on the ecosystems, here's the effect on agriculture, here's the effect on water resources. But one of the things we learned from working in cities is those are integrated. You will not get the right answer unless you begin to integrate across, unless we begin to integrate across. Now, this is very challenging because individually, what will happen to water, coasts, wetlands, infrastructure, energy, health? This is all very, very important. But the decisions, you can see the yellow line of the decisions links all of those. And this was the conceptual diagram that we used for the Metro East Coast Regional Assessment that provided the foundation of the work that we have since gone on to work with our decision makers without the federal leadership anymore, but our regional leaders and decision makers have taken up the slack to continue work. And we put the integration of people, place, and pulse meaning the economic effects, at the center, because in urban areas, and I believe actually everywhere, integration across those, it matters. For example, health and water are very linked. If you don't have your water supply or if you have changes in your water quality, you're going to have changes in your health. Sea level, wetlands, infrastructure, et cetera. And I'm going to very briefly show I'm not going to go into all of the details of the work that we do, but the low-lying coastal areas show the vulnerabilities. We have the tremendous vulnerability in urban areas on our transportation infrastructure. That's the entrance to the Holland Tunnel. But on the right, it shows our ecosystems as well. We have accelerated wetland loss in Jamaica Bay National Recreation Area, which is within the five boroughs of New York City. So this interplay between infrastructure and ecosystems is important to get the full picture of vulnerability. Energy and health. I mentioned water and health, but energy and health. Clearly, that when we have blackouts, we have vulnerability to older people and younger people in cities. We know that very, very much from the European 2003 heat wave, from the Chicago heat wave. And we also then linked to air quality. So you see that the forefront of the impacts field is to create these linkages between problems that we have now, such as the asthma in New York, the asthma epidemic in New York, with the increasing temperatures, therefore increasing ozone. Just in terms of energy, which is such a key part of it, we did projections of how peak demand would change. And here in the energy demand, we are doing a tremendous amount of work linking to the urban heat island. The urban heat island is a climate change that all cities have now. So we do work on the urban heat island and mitigation of the urban heat island, and therefore to help prepare for climate change. You can see how the integration of the timescales is beginning to happen. And this is illustrating work that we did that combines climate change, land use change, regional climate change, and air quality change, and health impacts. So there's a lot more pieces now that are coming forward in the studies that are being done now. Final point on what's new in this particular area is that we cannot look at cities, and I believe we can't look at climate change anywhere without thinking about socioeconomic vulnerability. And therefore, in cities, there is not equal vulnerability. So lack of material resources, the lifelines to cars and telephones, information and knowledge, race and ethnicity, the built environment, age, etc. These give a variegated vulnerability. And this is an important part that needs to be brought forward. In terms of responses, of course, cities are leaders for mitigation and adaptation. I'm just going to show one as I close, which is that New Yorkers are great because we told them about climate change, climate variability, and they say, okay, we got it. What are we going to do about it? And so already we are working with many groups across the city, the architects, the designers, the developers, et cetera. And one of the ideas that can do both mitigation and adaptation is green roofs, for example, that some of the cities in the West Coast and Chicago are doing. New York is looking at, is taking this on board too. So I think in terms of solutions, there's some very exciting parts that are coming that are new and that really is beginning to happen. This is my final one. I believe that we have finished the issue identification phase. I think we are entering the solution phase. This is where the exciting part is now. To just give the examples of what's happening in New York, the Mayor Bloomberg has just established the Office of Long-Term Planning and Sustainability. Climate change is one of the main topics that they have chosen to work on in terms in this office. We have worked with the DEP, which is famous for the 1840s, creating the water system of today that we have. They are looking 100 years in the future, and there is an agency-wide task force on climate change throughout the agency, not stovepiping just in one place or another. Finally, the C20 Summit on Climate Change and the World Cities and the Global Clinton Initiative have just merged, and we're going to be holding in New York a major conference on climate change in cities, and I invite you all to come. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Cynthia. And our final speaker this morning is Doug Inkley of the National Wildlife Federation.
Good morning. I'm very thrilled to be here on behalf of the National Wildlife Federation. You know, Jim and I were talking before this session got started that I had graduated from Michigan State University in 1976, and I was telling him how I missed some very exciting years because just as I was leaving, there was some obscure basketball player that had just signed on to attend Michigan State University by the name of Irvin Johnson. Not really sure who that guy was, but now I do know who he was. I'm also a University of Vermont graduate, and so it's kind of fun to be back home here. I don't know how many of you are from Vermont. How many of you are from Vermont? A few of you. So you know that this is typical weather. It's raining. So those of you that are from outside of Vermont, this is not so bad. This is actually kind of nice. You know, as Jim mentioned, he said that I'm not a journalist and I'm a source. And I'd like to quote those words right back to you that I am not a journalist. I am also a source. I'm the senior science advisor at the National Wildlife Federation. And one of my responsibilities there at the National Wildlife Federation is to make sure that everything that we do is science-based. If we don't make all of our work science-based, we don't have any credibility, but we also aren't going to succeed. So that's one of the things that we're very dedicated to. Another thing that we're dedicated to at this point in time is climate change. We view this as the most important issue that we're facing at this point in time and something that we as a nation and as a world absolutely need to address. But I'm not working alone on this issue. There's many people at the National Wildlife Federation that are involved in this. And if you're welcome to talk to me after this session, but also there are other people from the National Wildlife Federation that are here. I'm just going to ask them to stand up real quickly so that you can see who they are. Ariel Weinman and Christine Dorsey and Lisa Swan. And where's Aslan? Aslan Macis, there she is. And then John Kostiak, who is an attorney working on our endangered species programs and also very deeply involved in our climate change program. So there's a lot of people here that you're welcome to talk to. The issue about climate change that we face is a challenge in the field that I am in, which is wildlife conservation. I'm a certified wildlife biologist, is trying to make this issue of global climate change real. And it becomes very real to people when you start talking to them about wildlife. We heard the previous speakers talk about the impacts on our society and on our humans, but we also have to be very concerned about another aspect of our whole culture, which is the wildlife. And as wildlife is affected by climate change, so too will it affect our society. Now, I want to talk to you about wildlife in our backyard, and certainly this is not in our backyard, but I couldn't help but tell you about this because I've been up to Churchill, Manitoba, and seen the polar bears up there. And this is a classic example of where climate change is already having an impact. I can't emphasize enough that when we're talking about impacts on wildlife, we're not talking about just projections for impacts on wildlife. We're talking about what is happening now. So there are stories out there to be had, and you've all heard the stories about the polar bears, the drowning polar bears in the sea, and they have actually declined in the Hudson Bay region. It's the southernmost extent of the polar bear range. And what has happened there is with climate change is the sea ice is no longer there as long, and it's declined by an average of about 3 weeks a year in the last 20 years. At the same time, the polar bear population weights, the average weights of the polar bears has declined, and so has the population by about 10%. And the scientists all believe that this is very closely linked. The reason it's so linked is because polar bears, the only way they can catch food is to get on ice. And during the summertime, when you and I think all the animals are fattening up, the polar bears are sitting on land. They're not eating at all. They're not eating throughout the entire summer. And they can only eat once they get back on the ice because they don't have a chance of catching a seal in open water. So this is a real impact. Although it's not in our backyard, it is something that is very real, and it's happening now. Now, that's Al Gore on the right and Senator Imhoff on the left. I took this video from a vehicle, by the way, up in Churchill, Manitoba, just 2 years ago. One of my colleagues was up there last year at the same time, and she would film some similar things, but there was no snow in the background. I'm not going to attribute that to climate change, but I'm going to say there is a general trend that things are changing up there, and they're very worried about it because it's a primary economic driver for the town of Churchill. Coming into our own backyard, down into the lower 48 states, is what I've had to do when talking to people about wildlife conservation and about climate change. I had to make it real to them. And for a while, it was quite a challenge. But now, a whole lot of information is coming out, a whole lot of research is available, and I'd like to tell you about some of that information that's available and ways that you can look to through wildlife to report the story on climate change. One of those is through waterfowl. Most of you are probably familiar with the Prairie Pothole region, which is that light blue area up there in the upper central part of the United States and south central Canada. This is called the duck factory of North America. There are more ducks produced here than anywhere in the rest of the country. It's the old prairie, it's the prairie pothole region, which was glaciated some 10 or 15,000 years ago and shallowed out the land to make many temporary small ponds that dry up in the springtime, but are usually there long enough so that the waterfowl can breed. A tremendous importance. The thing that's interesting about the projections of climate change with the increased temperature is that these areas are expected to have a lot more evapotranspiration. And something that's important about this waterfowl in this area is that these ponds that they're using are ephemeral. They're temporary. They dry up in the spring. But with climate change, they'll either disappear or they'll dry up sooner. And that certainly is going to have an impact on waterfowl. Two scientific studies have come out, one just a month or two ago. Maybe it was 6 months ago. From the South Dakota State University, where they looked at the changes in waterfowl populations from the prairie pothole region, and they project up to a 70% decline in waterfowl from that region over the next 50 or 60 years. That's 7 out of every 10 ducks that would no longer be coming south or migrating to other areas of the country. The thing that's important about this, it's not just a prairie pothole region issue. It's an issue for every single state because waterfowl migrate everywhere. They go to Chesapeake Bay, they go to the Gulf Coast, they go to the Central Valley of California, they go up into Alaska. It is a national resource, and more ducks are produced in the prairie pothole region than any other region of the country. If you take a look at this, this is an example of spots where banded waterfowl were recovered by hunters in the same year in which the birds were banded. All of the birds were banded up in that prairie pothole region just to the west of Lake Superior. And then over the next year, they collected all the bands that the hunters turned in. And if you take a look at that, those waterfowl went everywhere. That really demonstrates it. Another way to look at climate change, to get to the issue of climate change through wildlife, is to look at endangered species. I know most of the states have their own state endangered species list, but we also have a large number of species on the federal and threatened endangered species list. All of these species are extremely vulnerable to climate change, and that's because they have low populations, so they're vulnerable to catastrophic events. They're vulnerable to changes in their habitat because oftentimes they're very specialized in the habitat that they require. So one way to look at the issue of climate change is by talking to the people in your state that deal with endangered species conservation, talking to the state fish and wildlife agencies and finding out what their concerns are. I can give you an example of a species that is not endangered but is declining. In Minnesota, they have two moose populations, one in the northeast part of the state and one in the northwest part of the state. The northwest population used to be hunted. It's no longer hunted. It is declining. They just don't have a season on it anymore. They don't think there's going to be moose in the northwest part of the state of Minnesota for very many more years. The studies indicate that it is climate change that is stressing the moose, that is making them more vulnerable to parasites, to predators, and low reproductivity. And so they're just disappearing off the landscape. They're just not there. You know, a moose begins to pant when it gets to be 67 degrees Fahrenheit. And when it gets hotter, they spend less time eating and they spend more time in the woods trying to stay cool. And they're not in as good nutritional condition. So endangered species, species with very specific habitat requirements are vulnerable. That's a way to look at climate change. You can also look at it through songbirds. This is just an example I've given you for two regions of the country. The Great Lakes region shows that 53% decline in existing breeding songbird species or migrant species. They're expecting that the ranges of a lot of these species are going to move northward. These projections are available for each of the regions of the country. I might add to you that one way that we've made it very understandable to the public, as we pointed out in looking at the Baltimore Oriole, which breeds in Maryland. It's the state bird of Maryland. According to the projections from climate change, the bird will no longer breed in the state of Maryland. So maybe the baseball team will have to move north as well. Another way to look at climate change is through fisheries impacts, especially cold water fisheries, trout. Trout are extremely sensitive to temperature. And when the temperature goes up, their reproductive success goes down, their health goes down, and it goes up even further. They simply cannot live there and they die. So we're expecting to see a loss of hundreds and thousands of miles of cold water trout streams that people have traditionally been using for decades. On the other hand, there's likely to be an increase in some warm water species, such as bass. And so there's a counterbalancing mechanism here. Now, not all climate change impacts are likely to be negative. But the sooner we address climate change and get it under control, the better we'll be, because the greater climate change that occurs, we expect more of those impacts to be negative. So we really must address this issue now. But there are pros and cons, and one of them is some of the warm water species will do better, but at the expense of the cold water species. Another way to look at it is through the wildlife and fisheries impacts from increased fires and reduced snowpack. I mean, this year, the number of fires, the acreage of fires that was burned in the United States was double what it has been in the average over the past 10 years. And there's been recent science that came out this year that indicated that this increase in fires burned and intensity is closely related to the increased temperatures throughout the West. And it's not just for this year, but it's for a long-term trend. Associated with that is a reduction in the snowpack in the mountains. The snowpack provides water, which is critical to agriculture and which is critical to cities, and people are concerned about that. But it's critical to fisheries as well. With reduced snowpack and more rapid runoff in the springtime, when the warmer temperatures do come, it means that a lot of these streams that used to flow year-round are likely to become temporary or ephemeral in nature. They'll dry up towards the end of the summer. That changes the entire ecology of the stream, and many of the fisheries resources that are in that stream can no longer survive there. So that's another way to look at climate change, especially if you're from the West. When we're looking at fisheries and wildlife impacts, we have to look at habitat changes. The top map shows the current habitat distributions across the United States, and the lower two maps from the Forest Service show projections for how habitats would change or shift across the country based on two different models that are available. Actually, they're both a conglomeration of models, but we're not exactly certain how it'll change, but certainly change is in the forecast. I mentioned to you earlier that we have to be concerned not about the wildlife and fisheries themselves, but about their impact on people. Certainly, it's going to affect people that are anglers, that are hunters, that are bird watchers, anybody that enjoys wildlife. I don't know anybody in the country who doesn't enjoy wildlife, so I think it's an effective way to reach out to people. The National Wildlife Federation does have a lot of information available on a state-by-state basis. We can give you the number of fish and wildlife species in a state. The Fish and Wildlife Service has done surveys. We know How many people are hunting, fishing, and are wildlife watching participants in each of the states? We know how many jobs that supports, another way to talk about climate change impacts. And we know the annual expenditures that people put forth in pursuing these activities of hunting, fishing, and wildlife watching. All this information is available. Much of that is from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But we also have a lot of information available over on the table from the National Wildlife Federation. It's on disk, but we also have some other handouts. We do have state-by-state fact sheets of the potential impacts of climate change. Also, you're always welcome to contact me, and if I don't know the answer, I'm happy to refer you in the right direction. Another source of climate change information, which kind of provided a baseline for the wildlife agencies dealing with this, was Global Climate Change and Wildlife in North America by the Wildlife Society. That is also available on that disk that's over at the side. It's also available on a website called targetglobalwarming.org, which the National Wildlife Federation operates. It's targetglobalwarming.org. And I think it's important for the National Wildlife Federation to get the word out through folks like you, because we're concerned that we won't take action soon enough. And as Cynthia mentioned, you know, these are things that we have to deal with now, not something that we have to deal with just in the future. The future is what our children are going to be living in. So even if it's 50 years out from now, we can make it relevant to people that are around us today, because it's their children and their grandchildren. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We're now going to open it up to questions, and I'm going to ask again, please, journalists first.
My name is Ron Fries, and I'm from Manitoba, where the polar bears roam. And I'd just like to point out another interesting impact of global warming on Arctic Canada, which has political implications. It's possible, if this model continues, that what we call the Northwest Passage, the channel through the island of Northwest Territories, may be open year-round. Canada claims that these waters are territorial waters. The United States does not recognize that claim. The U.S. has made it pretty clear that if these channels are open year-round, it intends to send commercial shipping through there. So you have a very real possibility of cargo ships and oil tankers going through the Northwest Passage and all of the risks that entails. I was wondering if anyone on the panel would like to talk about the possible geopolitical impacts of global warming, such as the example I just cited.
All right, so the question is, does anyone have questions about the geopolitical impact of climate change? This is being taped, so I'm going to ask people to speak into the microphone.
Would you rephrase the question for the mic? I know you want us to do that.
Rephrase the question?
For the mic.
Oh, okay. Well, I think I just did, but the question is about what is the impact of the geopolitical impact of climate change? Does anyone here have any comments?
That's a huge question. I think it's also the case that with the prospect of the loss of sea ice in the Arctic region, that Denmark, for example, has indicated its intention to exercise its right to do oil drilling up there. So you open up a lot of interesting things in the Arctic region, in particular where climate change is most observable now, as the models would project. You know, that's just one aspect of it. I won't try to give a whole long thing on the geopolitical aspects. I think it's a huge question.
If I could go ahead and add to that, Doug Inkley, National Wildlife Federation. I'd like to take a different approach on looking at the geopolitical aspects, and that is that very recently the National Wildlife Federation conducted a poll of hunters and anglers across the country to see what their attitudes were about climate change. And it was resoundingly clear that hunters and anglers, and they're generally conservative, are very much concerned about the issue of climate change. And another thing that the survey revealed was that they would like the U.S. government to take leadership on this issue. And I think it's critically important that the U.S. government take leadership on this issue, not only for us, but for around the world. And they need to address things such as this passageway that the implications are huge. There's a heck of an economic opportunity for the United States. And as long as we continue to deny climate change or don't really want to address it, we're denying ourselves the economic opportunity to address the issue through the development of alternative energy sources, greater conservation measures, et cetera. We have an opportunity to be a leader in this through an economic way as well.
Gideon.
Gideon Hill with Boston Globe. My question is, when you talk about regional and localized climate change, the science is not at the stage yet to be able to make a link between those localized changes to the broader global warming picture. How do you suggest as journalists we write about that or frame the local changes to the broader global warming picture? And can you talk about where the science is in trying to connect those dots?
All right, so the question is about how do you connect the dots of the broader scientific changes to the localized impacts?
My first response is hang on till AR4 comes out with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is a particular issue. The relationship between regions and global climate is a particular issue that is being assessed. I think that with appropriate caveats, as I gave in my talk, the linkages can be made. For example, as I said, there are changes in many places around the world. It's very hard to associate exactly any particular change, but the concatenation of the changes that we are seeing is and are suggestive of what we know from the climate science. So I think with appropriate caveats, that those points and those linkages do need to be made, because we may also be erring on the other side, that by focusing so much on the uncertainties, that we may be missing this larger picture. So I think putting the local, linking to the global context. There will be help also in the fourth assessment report, which is going to be, which is assessing that particular issue.
And Cynthia, when will that be coming out again?
They're timed over the 2004. The working group one is on the science side, and I believe that is January 2007. January 2007 for the climate science working group one. The working group two, of which I am a member of the science writing team, on observed changes is the part I'm working on, and that is due in April 2007, and then working group three on the mitigation responses is, I think, in early fall. And just one further comment about that, we are doing an extensive review of every single scientific study of the observed changes globally, and in working group two for the first time, there's a chapter that is just focused on the observed changes.
What the first group is, what is their focus?
Climate science.
The physical climate
system. The physical climate system. Working group two is impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. And working group three is mitigation.
So the regional focus would be in?
It's the climate aspect, it's in both. And in some cases all three. But the climate aspects are dealt with to a certain extent in working group one. And then the linkage between the effects, the regional scale, and the global scales are in working group two. And the changes at the local scale, too.
Okay.
Projections now, and I'm wondering what your thought is on our ability to
Yes. Well,
so the question is about regional models and our ability to create them now.
The science is always evolving. That is the challenge, that the science will never be, everything is a done deal and now we can just go on. And the modeling is very much an example of that. All models will never, are models. They never encapsulate all the complexities of the system. So I believe that we have to use them with care, but they also encapsulate our current knowledge. And therefore, what we do is that we are, you can see that I'm showing you what actually I had, we just presented, for example, to the mayor's office in New York City. But that's why I think that it's important to express the uncertainty in the range of models and continue to list the caveats about their uncertainty. But at the same time, these are what the models show. We also need to, though, have at the same time the other information on the side about possibly faster surprises due to what's happening at the ice sheets. So, again, I think, yes, the regional models, but used in a careful context.
All right, the question is, what is a heat island and how is that related to climate change? Yeah, and please identify yourself, too.
The urban heat island is an effect of warming due to the use of materials in built environments and the removal of vegetation that makes cities in particular warmer than the surrounding rural areas. The New York City Urban Heat Island has been in place for over 100 years. We've looked back, and it also happens even in a small suburban, with a suburban development and a mall, those parking lots are causing local hotspots. Because urban built areas are warmer than the surrounding areas, they are again another analogy of a current situation that we are dealing with that's warmer, that we can then learn about the effects of warming to right now in the current. So what we have been finding in our group is that many decision makers are becoming much more interested in the urban heat island and mitigating the urban heat island. And by mitigating in terms of street tree planting, the green roof example that I showed, that is then getting things in place that are helping now, that then also are solutions for adapting and mitigating to climate change. So they're it's a very good example of how win-win situations solutions can be brought forward.
Tom Burke, County Review, Long Island, New York. Rick, any concern, or based on your experience, concerns about AR4 and, censorship or whatever word you want to use in terms of how it's going to present the material?
All right, there's a question for Rick and about any of his concerns about possible censorship of this report.
Well, the report is being produced by an international teams of scientists under UN sponsorship, and it's the underpinning for the diplomatic and negotiations. So it's not something that is directly controlled by the U.S. government. However, the policymaker summaries to those things are approved line by line by the parties to the treaty, and the third assessment report came out in 2001. It was all approved before the Bush administration was really quite in place to have much influence on that process. So we'll see how they participate in the policymaker summary aspect of it. But I think a greater concern is that we see now in Washington already what I would call an orchestrated effort to undermine people's confidence in the credibility of the IPCC climate change assessment in advance of its publication. I think, for example, the entire political attack on the paleoclimatologists who put together the 1,000-year temperature record, the so-called hockey stick controversy, is a proxy for an attack on the IPCC, because the 1,000-year temperature record and showing the 20th century warming up was prominently featured in the third IPCC assessment, and is by being tied to that very explicitly by the chairman of the House Energy Committee and by Senator Inhofe and so forth. I think there is a special interest-driven political campaign to portray the mainstream climate science community as itself being some kind of special interest group, so that when something comes out that's been extremely vetted and painstakingly developed by the entire mainstream international climate research community, and should be taken by non-experts, I think, since the summaries are understandable in reasonably plain English, should be taken as an authoritative assessment. They want people to think when that comes out that there's something a little controversial about it, something a little shady about it. Maybe it's got something to do with something about the United Nations that we don't like, or maybe this is an advocacy group of scientists that's just spinning up this issue because they're on the take for research money, and there will be kind of a swift boating type of attack on the IPCC. And I think the groundwork is already being laid for that, both inside and outside of the government. And you really need to be alert to that.
Could you just give us another quick explanation of the one you said I didn't quite understand, on the one about a new way of looking at risk?
Yes.
All right. It's a question for Cynthia about her slide on risk.
Yes.
How does that work?
Sure. I'm going to stand up. I'm going to come over. What this graph represents is rather than taking one GCM scenario and one emission scenario and saying this is what climate change will be in a particular year, global climate model, it's taking a set of them, because now there are more available to us. When we first started out, there were just a few, really. Now, actually, on the PCMDI website, there are actually 18 GCMs that have run the emission scenarios, and they've run three. What we have done is selected based on a selection criteria in terms of the models that have had the most development, that have years of peer review development on them. We selected five of the global climate models, and we take their set for these three decades of low, medium, and high emission scenarios. So we then have 15 for the 2020s. We have 15 possible future climates. And then we arrange them according to how much temperature increase they are showing. What this does is it expresses the range, right, from 1 to 3 in the 2020s. And it also shows where those model emission scenarios are, there are the most. So it's saying that most of the models for the 2020s are projecting that the temperature rise for the New York City region is 1.5 to 2 degrees. But there are outliers as well. It might be as low as 1, it might be 3. So for decision makers, this follows on to your question too, about how do we begin now. These are downscale to our region. How do we then begin to bring the climate modeling into decision making? And what we do this, I think that this is a useful way of doing it, because you're not just giving one number, and we better build those New York City sewers. What sewers are one of the first things that we're going to be, that we're working, that the DEP is working on. But it's much more realistic because it shows the range. Here's the outliers, but also the median. GIS, because that's our home model. The GIS, GCM, GFDL. Do you know the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory from NOAA, and that's down in Princeton? And one of the two NCAR models that we feel was doing a better job, the NOAA, NCAR CCSM, and then two European models, the Hadley from the UK Met Office, the Hadley Center model, and then the model from Germany, from the Max Planck Institute. It's called ECHAM, ECHAM.
Okay. Andy?
The hockey stick issue is worth re-examining. Michael Mann, he wrote his 1998 whatever paper, it was laden with caveats that explained the lack of confidence in data or whatever. But when this came down to this dirty realm where science and policy intersect, scientists were trying to be as policy relevant as possible, when they made their graph over the report, they really took away the error bar. So obviously there's an eagerness to make the point that there's a lot of reason to think we're in a real warming exposure after the warm flat period. But that, in doing that, they left themselves open into legitimate criticism, not just by the environmental people, but others who really feel that that's not supportable. And so it's then you as journalists who are trying to get the shorthanded aspect of this, there it is. So we can't necessarily assume that I think they're going to do a better job this time, because I think they learned by most of these people learn lessons. But it's always the best where the really big public. And the summaries for policymakers are very problematic exercise. You can try to make a point and also stay on the science. Sometimes
any comments on the hockey stick or?
Well, Andy, you yourself have suggested that reporters and policymakers should not be sort of blown about by the latest, the study that is reported, Antarctic is melting, Antarctic is not melting, things that are just hot off the presses, issues that are very much in play. It's too easy to demagogue on that stuff. There's too much uncertainty. It's all interesting to follow and try to absorb. But I do think that the well-vetted, comprehensive national and international assessments, the IPCC, the Arctic, and so forth, do have a somewhat different status than the latest news report, and that it is important for policymakers and journalists to pay close attention to them, to regard them as, not sacrosanct, but I would say pretty authoritative and representing the best considered, well-vetted judgment of the leading scientists, and that you should not be too quick to allow them to be undermined in the public eye by interests that are clearly politically driven with an agenda of deflecting attention from the urgency of the global warming problem. I anticipate that there'll be a number of fairly strong conclusions in the forthcoming report. And yes, there will be a tendency on one side to overhype some of those things in an oversimplified way. But I still think that if you look carefully at what's in the reports, that you need to take those seriously. And they're about as authoritative and comprehensive as you're going to get. It's not just another thing,
the IPCC drafts were like. And so when it goes to the diplomatic realm,
Now, let me just, we have time for just one more question. Here. So the question is, why? What is the reason for the state of denial in the Bush administration?
Well, I don't think we should oversimplify it, but I do think that this administration came in, one, with close ties to important economic interests in the energy industry and elsewhere, that have that don't want to see a global warming regulatory regime, restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions. And this is the kind of administration that is very quick to come to political conclusions to carry out that sort of agenda, and they tend to be immune to alternative perspectives, policy analysis, and scientific evidence. I also think another aspect of it is they seem to bring with them a kind of ideological, operational animus against proactive government problem solving and preparedness, and we've seen it in a number of areas. The Hurricane Katrina aftermath is a spectacular example, but we've seen it as a modus operandi with the administration. Things happen, and they say, well, how could we have possibly known to be prepared for this? And I think that to take the mainstream science conclusions on global climate change seriously, to acknowledge that there's an issue that requires a response strategy, implies that you set in motion public investment, regulatory activity, policy making, infrastructure planning, and a whole range of government activist responses that is just not what they're about. It's not what brings them to power. It's not what keeps them in power. But society pays the price for it. I mean, I just have an obvious advocacy position on this, but I think it's just empirically what we observe. There's a problem with policy making and preparedness here.
All right. We're going to have to conclude this panel. I want to thank Doug, Rick, and Cynthia.